This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 99.
And accounting, in particular financial accounting, is defining the rules that determine who is winning, particularly in public companies. Those rules don't look very much like our simple-minded view of efficiency. And just give you a couple of quick examples. Financial accounting is created in a period where physical capital was everything that was kind of important. And human capital and intellectual capital was really not anything anybody paid any attention to. So if you were to say, for example, well, what's the value of the human capital in this company? They'd say, there is no value. I said, what do you mean there's no value? Well, you can only be an asset and contribute to value if you are owned. And because you can't own people, then they don't have any value. They have no asset value. And you say, well, what if they're under contract, like professional sports? No value because you don't own them. What if we make investments in them? But you can't make investments in employees because you can only invest in an asset. Because you don't own employees, training can't be an investment, right? So what is training? Well, it's a current operating expense. It's like what you spend for breakfast and pizza and coffees and things.
Why is it time to rethink how we value and measure human capital? How can you influence the business to take a longer-term view when making investments in your people? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversation, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Hey everybody, as I've recently announced, I have started my own company to focus on developing next-gen HR leaders and elevating talent practices. And I wanted to give you a quick update on how things are going so far. In addition to preparing for my Next Gen HR Accelerator program, which will kick off on September 10th, I'm also consulting with CHROs to help them improve the effectiveness of their HR functions and elevate the talent practices in their organizations. In fact, I recently designed and led an HR leadership team offsite for a $9 billion global organization to help them be an even more effective and aligned team. So if you're a CHRO looking to take your HR function or talent practices to the next level, I would love to have a conversation to see how I can help you get there faster and with more impact. And last but not least, I'm also excited and honored to share that I'll be speaking at three internal HR conferences for three amazing organizations in September and October. If you have an HR meeting or HR conference coming up and you're looking for a speaker, I would love to hear from you. And with that, my guest this week is Peter Capelli. Peter is the George W. Taylor Professor of Management at the Wharton School and Director of Wharton Center for Human Resources. He was recently named by HR Magazine as one of the top five most influential management thinkers, by NPR as one of the 50 influencers in the field of aging, and was elected a fellow of the National Academy of Human Resources, which is the highest honor in our field. He's also a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal and writes a monthly column for HR Executive Magazine, and his work on performance management, agile systems, and hiring practices, and other workplace topics appears in Harvard Business Review on a regular basis. Peter's also authored or co-authored at least 12 books, and his latest book might be his most important one yet, which is why I asked him to come on the podcast to discuss it. His latest book is called Our Least Important Asset: While the Relentless Focus on Finance and Accounting is Bad for Business and Employees. In Our Least Important Asset, Peter breaks down how the rules of financial accounting is driving many of the people decisions that organizations make, often with undesirable outcomes. As HR leaders, it's important that we understand the basics of financial accounting, how this impacts human capital decisions, and how we can best influence our leaders to make better decisions that take a longer-term view. I encourage you to read Peter's latest book and his older books as well. My personal favorite is Talent on Demand. And what you will find in his books and hear today is that Peter has an incredible way of helping understand the past and creating a bridge to the future. This was an insightful conversation with Peter as we discussed why people are the least important asset according to current financial accounting practices. The real reason companies do layoffs, hint, it's often not about cost savings. What HR leaders can do to communicate the tangible and intangible costs of layoffs. Why hiring decisions are the most important decisions organizations make. Why companies complain about skill gaps and why lack of skills is not really the problem. And his advice for HR leaders on what they should be doing in 2024 and beyond. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen. Drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Peter Capelli. Peter, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I am just ducky, as they say, or as they also say, I'm still horizontal, or vertical, whichever it is, I'm standing. So that's always good.
Well, we're glad that you are still standing. And more importantly, we're really glad you came by to join us in the podcast today, because I've admired your work for a long time and really seen you as a thought leader in the areas of HR and talent. And so this conversation is special for that reason. But I also think you've got a point of view that honestly, it needs to be heard, and it's unique in the industry and unique and honestly in academia. So I'm excited to talk more about your work. And looking at your career, you really have been researching and writing about HR, talent, and how we work for your entire career. What made you decide to focus on your energy and your passion in these areas?
Well, I didn't decide. It was like a job interview. You're trying to make sense of things that you did that didn't make perfect sense. I began my career studying unions, and basically coincided with the collapse of unions. The collective bargaining and the union system had almost nothing to do with human resources, right? Except it was the big enchilada in the company. So human resources was called personnel, and it reported to industrial relations. At the executive vice president level, it was always an industrial relations person. People who handled unions, right? Dave Ulrich's famous phrase, getting a seat at the table. That's because industrial relations had a seat at the table, but personnel never did. And industrial relations didn't pay much attention to human resources. So I was interested in public policy stuff, and I was studying first the collapse of unions, but then there's not much to say after they collapsed. So I was interested in public policy in graduate school too. I spent about 10 years around Washington, first in the labor department and then in the education department. And the policy questions were about, skills in the labor force and wage growth and all those kinds of things. And it seemed pretty clear after a little bit that a huge proportion of what was happening to people and what happened in general, good or bad, had to do with employer decisions. So I was interested in employer decisions because they affected policy. Like, who do you hire? Do you train people? Do you lay people off or do you try to retain them, right? These employer policies are the big deal in terms of what is always new now and what has changed, right? So I got interested in those questions later. So I actually came to human resources kind of late. I wrote a book called Change at Work, which was many authors trying to explain what had happened to employment and employer relations. It was sponsored by a group, tellingly, called the National Planning Society. And it was a group of union and management people that got together back from the New Deal when they thought they could kind of plan society. They commissioned it. And so we wrote about what was happening to jobs, to job security, to wages, all that sort of stuff. So this is the mid-90s. And you could see that the big, enormous restructuring that went on the U.S. economy from 1980s through then was largely just pushing the cost of that onto employees, cutting defined benefit plans, a lot of layoffs, changes by some measures, kind of taking away the implicit contract that employers had with employees. So the book was kind of about that. And then I wrote this book called The New Deal at Work, which was about the decline of lifetime employment and what does that look like. Interestingly, it seemed obvious at the time, right? We had white collar layoffs for the first time in the 1980s or so. And then it was just systematic dismantling of systems for the next 30 years or so. So it seemed pretty obvious that something different was going on. You could look at executive search and job boards like Monster, and it was pretty clear people were hopping around more. And well, a lot of people didn't believe it. And I think they had a vested interest in not believing it, even though eventually even the Bureau of Labor Statistics data showed that was true. From there, I was into these topics of what are employers doing? Ultimately, if you're into that question, you're interested in what's happening to the practice of human resources, the extent to which they are calling shots. It's not clear they are calling shots or have been, which has been one of the big challenges, right? So anyway, that's how I got to that path. It was not straightforward to get there.
No careers are really as straightforward as we'd like them to be. But some of the books we're going to talk about today, I think, does help really give you the history of how we have shifted from the 80s to where we are to now in 2024. We're still seeing lots of layoffs. There is sort of a new deal at work. And I think you've got generations coming up now evaluating, what does this mean? How does this look for me in my career?
Yeah.
But your latest book is actually a really important one called Our Least Important Asset: Why the Relentless Focus on Finance and Accounting is Bad for Business and Employees. What made you decide to write this latest book, and who did you write it for?
Again, the twisted path that gets you to a place. You probably know that the last thing you write in a book is the introduction, because you never actually know what the book is going to be about for sure until you finished writing it, right? So this book was supposed to be a kind of explanation of how we really are managed. The original title I had in mind for this was just Modern Human Resources. I mean, how do we actually hire people as opposed to what the books say? And apologies to my colleagues who write these, but if you looked at human resource textbooks, it still looks like the 1950s. The job analysis and the job evaluation, and then creating the interviews, questions you're going to ask, and the tests you're going to use. And last year or so, the majority of people who moved say they never even looked for a job. Somebody came and got them. So I thought, you know, it'd probably be important to just lay out, how do we actually hire people? How do we actually manage performance? What do we actually do on training? As opposed to the textbooks, which were still based on that pre-restructuring model of human resources personnel from the 1950s on through, which was quite an elaborate and sophisticated system. It just has been coming apart for 30 years. So I was starting to write that chapter by chapter, and it's the common theme was you could sort of see the bones of the old system, but it was like everything was scraped off it. And then you could see this kind of over and over in practice after practice. Why would you do this? Why would you take these practices and just leave the skeleton of them, but effectively so much is gone, they don't do what you think they're doing anymore? And so then I started to maybe think, what was the common theme? But the common theme was pretty simple and straightforward. And that had to do with the pressures on the cost side. Then the question, of course, is, okay, everybody thinks that employers are rational calculating machines, and they're always doing things efficiently, and it must be efficient to lay people off, and it must make sense to hire without recruiters because it's cheaper. They're always trying to do things cheaper, right? But then you could see these things are not cheaper. So if you hire badly, for example, because you get rid of recruiters, well, you're pushing all the tasks onto line managers, who are actually more expensive than recruiters. So it's kind of like reverse industrial engineering. Let's make things more expensive. Let's push simple tasks onto more expensive people. And then because you're doing it badly, you're going to have more turnover, and that's going to cost you too. So why are we doing these things which are ultimately more expensive? It's penny wise and pound foolish, as the British would say. Why would you be doing that? Well, and that takes you to the question of accounting. Those of us who grew up in the 1980s especially had this 1980s kind of version of economics, which was kind of banked into us, this completely rational worldview. Everything was optimizing. Anything that was not rational was just discounted. You used to be able to stop discussions, this is seriously, policy discussions, by saying, well, if it was really a problem, the market would have taken care of it. People would say, oh, yeah, yeah, and that was kind of it, right? Well, the idea that we have from that is that companies are obviously trying to do things efficiently as possible. So by cutting costs, that would be efficient. But then you could see, well, these things are not cutting costs. They're just cutting a particular type of cost. So why is that happening? Well, then I had to make my father proud, who always wanted me to take an accounting class, and I never took one, but I had to go back and learn it all. And I had tolerant colleagues who helped me understand at least these parts of it. But, you know.
So later, so you're saying recently, Peter. So
went back to
accounting just
when I wrote before, when I was writing this book.
Okay, wow, that's great. So, I wasn't sure.
And this is not well planned, you know. If you think about what accountants will tell you, if you just sit down with an accountant and you say, all right, so I just want to be efficient, so I'll just cut my costs as little as possible. As Henry Ford says, we'll put all the money coming in a barrel, we'll just take out what we spend and the rest is profit, right? And they will laugh at you for a while, right? Because what counts as a cost depends on where it sits and how big an issue that is depends on where it sits in a dollar of revenue. The effect of that varies depending on where it sits. And if you're trying to move shareholder value, which is really the contemporary issue, it's not about profitability. It's about moving shareholder value. Shareholder value is not about current profit anyway. It's about anticipated views of what profit will be, right? It's future oriented. Then it's pretty clear that what companies are actually trying to do, think about this as like a game of basketball. If you just took 1980s economics, you would say, the basketball is just about putting ball in hoop. Very simple. And then you'd say, well, why don't you just get a very tall guy, put somebody on his shoulders, stand right underneath the basket and just keep popping the ball in. Well, you can't do that. Well, how about you just knock the other players down, which you kind of can do depending on the NBA refs these days. Well, you can't do that either. Those are fouls. Okay, well, what's a foul? And then it depends where you shoot from. Okay, well, where does, you know, and you end up with these complicated rules that define the game of basketball. And accounting, in particular, financial accounting, is defining the rules that determine who is winning, particularly in public companies. Those rules don't look very much like our simple-minded view of efficiency. And just give you a couple of quick examples. Financial accounting is created in a period where physical capital was everything that was kind of important. And human capital and intellectual capital was really not anything anybody paid any attention to. So if you were to say, for example, well, what's the value of the human capital in this company? They'd say, there is no value. I said, what do you mean there's no value? Well, you can only be an asset and contribute to value if you are owned. And because you can't own people, then they don't have any value. They have no asset value. And you say, well, what if they're under contract, like professional sports? No value because you don't own them. What if we make investments in them? Well, you can't make investments in employees because you can only invest in an asset because you don't own employees. Training can't be an investment, right? So what is training? Well, it's a current operating expense. It's like what you spend for breakfast and pizza and coffees and things. Keep the office going, that sort of stuff. It falls under there. And then the other quirky, the biggest quirky thing is if you look at a lot of financial output that companies are used, are judged by, a lot of it is on a per employee basis. So if you cut your headcount, you're cutting the denominator and then quickly your value just shoots up. If you cut your denominator in half, you double your value. Well, you still got to get the work done though. Like, we wouldn't do that. Well, you can replace your current employees with contracts. You can replace them with leased employees. Why has that exploded so much? Drives your headcount down. And then the value of your company shoots way up. And you look at things like this bizarre notion of unlimited vacations, right? Which continue to be sold as this benefit to employees. But the reason it was done is unlimited vacations means you're getting rid of accrued liability. And that is, with most vacation plans, you earn the vacation days based on your contribution. And the employer owes that to you. And so those are liabilities on your accounts. If you get rid of that and replace with unlimited vacations, which is basically just a kind of promise, not a legal promise, then suddenly your value escalates because your liabilities fall. So there's a bunch of things that affect financial accounting, which cause us to do things which are penny wise and pound foolish. So investors really don't like employment costs. They still, for some reason, believe they're fixed costs. We're laying off people pretty easily all the time. So they don't like employment costs. So drive those down. And by the way, if you drive them down by replacing your employers with other people, then suddenly your value shoots up as well. We can't train people, I'm sorry, because that's an expense that just disappears. We don't get any credit for it, et cetera, et cetera. So you could start to see in every one of the management practices why we're doing things which look stupid from a efficiency point of view. And the reason is they're not stupid from a financial accounting point of view. So if you let your CFO call all the shots, this is the way the company will run. So the problem, I think, for leaders is that the CEO has to be the person who balances that view. The CFO is kind of representing the interests of the investor community. The managers, line managers, are thinking we need good people, we need them to stay, et cetera. And the human resource people are saying, don't bang people around, don't beat them up because they'll quit, they won't perform. So the CEO should be listening to all these things and striking a balance. If they're only listening to the CFO, you get this really wacky behavior. And that's largely what we've been seeing.
Hey, everyone. We'll be back in a moment after a quick break. Isn't it time HR invests in HR? We often hear the feedback that HR leaders need to have more business acumen. HR leaders need to be more strategic, that we need to be able to influence and communicate with impact, that we need to be able to drive and support the business. Yet most HR functions don't have the time, resources, or capabilities to make this important development investment in their HR leaders. And while many HR functions have looked externally to fill this development gap, they haven't found the right program that combines world-class content with the skills, tools, and frameworks needed to be a strategic business partner. A program that's trusted by Fortune 500 companies, a program that focuses on real-world implementation and delivering results, a program that offers hands-on support to elevate and level up next-gen HR leaders. That is until now. The NextGen HR Accelerator is an intensive 4-week virtual cohort-based program designed to equip NextGen HR talent with the skills, mindset, and tools they need to become strategic business leaders. Leading companies like Verizon, Cardinal Health, General Mills, Prudential, and AbbVie have all benefited from this transformative program. And the good news is the next cohort will kick off on September 10th through October 3rd. While we do expect to sell out and space is limited, there's still time to sign up. To learn more about the NextGen HR Accelerator and how to elevate your team's strategic capabilities and business impact, go to futureofhr.com and you can request a brochure be sent to your inbox, or you can email me directly at jp@futureofhr.com and I'd be happy to provide more information on the program. NextGen HR Accelerator is the most comprehensive leadership development program for HR directors and managers focused on business acumen, strategic thinking, influence and communication skills, and business strategy. Don't miss this opportunity to invest in your team. Reserve your spot today.
Thanks so much to unpack there, Peter. And I think, you know, as people kind of try to understand this, and let me see if I can summarize the way I think about this, is that we do live in a world where shareholder value and creating shareholder value in the stock market is what drives a lot of behaviors. And it's short-term oriented. We're looking at what's the next quarter, the quarter after that. And you only have to look at what happened at Facebook just recently, where they had a blowout quarter. Facebook has actually eliminated 22,000 jobs. It's almost a quarter of their entire workforce. Yet they're able to, I believe, grow sales revenue top line 25% and reduce bottom line cost by 8%, but it's largely through headcount. And of course, the stock went through the roof. That is the game that we're playing. And that makes it challenging for HR leaders because we want to invest in our employees. But we are seeing them as liabilities, which means that they are something you don't want to have on your profit and loss statement versus an asset like we go buy a piece of manufacturing equipment. And we can now write that off over a 10-year period.
Yep.
Or we buy a,
appreciate it.
You know, have an office. We can invest in the office and improve the office. That's going to be something we can deduct, right, off our taxes. And it's a good thing for the business. And that's why you say CFOs. And I know one thing you talked about in the book is it's easier to go buy software, go buy a new SaaS tool, and it is to actually go get headcount to do that, because the tool will be depreciated over a number of years, whereas the headcount will hit that year operating cost and will hurt the books in terms of cash flow and, yep, and look bad for investors. So the system is not really helping us.
Yeah. Just one quick point on that. The idea about depreciation is that you don't have to pay something off that year. You can spread it out over time. But for a trading, quote, investment, you have to pay it off that year. So if you invest in sending somebody to some executive program, you have to see the return that year. If it was a piece of equipment or software, you could pay it off over 10 years. And if it didn't pay off in the first year, it wouldn't be a big deal. There's lots of ways in which this is really causing us to do weird things.
this podcast and our conversation, we can't change this. We're not saying, hey, we're going to go change this tomorrow, but to bring this to bear and to bring it to light for HR leaders to think about this a little bit more.
Yep.
Because I think your point was really well said that the CEO, and there are some enlightened CFOs out there, but you know, they have a main mission around probably investors and making sure that we're hitting numbers.
Right.
Just like the HR team is really making sure we're thinking about people and how that we have the capabilities and talent to win in the marketplace and how we bring that to bear. But I think the idea of taking that and saying, hey, we're making this investment in training. Now, we can't depreciate that, but we need to think about this as a longer term investment, right? We know it's going to still hit the books the way we do it today. But those kind of mindset shifts and having this conversation, I think, are honestly great ways to start to bring leaders to bear and have this conversation much more in a candid way, because I don't think it's always been brought up this way. Have you seen that work, Peter? What are you seeing when you talk to executives about this?
And one thing, just to back up a little on the layoff thing, there has been no evidence showing that these layoffs pay off in the even intermediate period. Facebook laid off people and top line revenues were growing. There's no evidence that it was because they laid off people. It would have grown anyway. Something was happening in the economy and they're stabilizing what they were doing. It was causing it to grow. The investors look at it and say, yay, see, you can now operate with fewer people. We told you so. If you think about it, that's really bizarre, right? That an investor who really doesn't understand your business at all, can't see inside it, knows better than the leaders do as to what the appropriate mix of employees should be. I mean, it's just bizarre. So the evidence on this has been that actually the best evidence recently, give my colleague Wayne Cassio and his colleagues who did this work a plug, finds that the sooner you lay off and the harder, the worse your financial performance is later on. And the reason you cut jobs, work doesn't necessarily get done. And you end up rehiring people. You saw this at Google and Facebook. They're hiring people. They went through this whole layoff, but now they're hiring. And the reason they laid off is because the investors told them they kind of had to, and you didn't want to look like you were ignoring the investors. And then once one company does it, then those investors go to the boards of the other companies and say, hey, Google laid off 6%. Why can't you lay off, right? And then you look weak if you don't do it. So back to your question, I think what human resources has to do is persuade the CEO of the facts, what the costs are. So one of my colleagues was telling me he was at an HR meeting a while ago, and he asked the HR people there if they knew what their costs of turnover were. You know, what number was it? And maybe they did, and they just wouldn't raise their hand, but like nobody raised their hand. And I've certainly talked to executives who have no idea what the cost of turnover is. If you think turnover doesn't cost you anything, then the way you manage the company is going to be really different. You won't care if they're layoffs. Yeah, we'll lay people off. We'll hire new people later on. Be fine. They're interchangeable. So I think you have to start with that. If we lay off these people, this is what it's going to cost us in terms of higher compensation, because we have to hire new people in and they're getting paid a premium these days just to move. We have a performance lag. It takes these people a few years to get to perform as well. We got disruptions in various places because of this. The biggest disruption, our colleague Peter Kuhn and his colleagues did this really interesting study looking at layoffs and the cost of it in simple retail operations. And the biggest cost was something we never looked at. And that was employees who remain are wasting a lot of time trying to fill the jobs. Some of it is just showing candidates around. They get dragged into interviews and that sort of stuff. There's a ton of costs. We haven't measured them carefully because we haven't tried. And the C-suite people don't even know that they're there. So it's no surprise that the CFO view is going to win because the CEO doesn't hear the alternatives, right?
Well, and I think those are really all great points. And sometimes those intangible costs, because there's hard costs of turnover, there's the soft cost of turnover, which can be very difficult to measure. And then you get into arguments of, well, you know, I've been there. What's the soft cost? What's this mean? How do you quantify it? And I think it does depend on the role and the jobs and all that. But the reality is there's cost for turnover.
Sure. And one of the things you probably remember from corporate world is the marketing people have no trouble with that stuff. You know, they just make a claim and say, here's our best guess as to what it costs. And, you know, in the absence of other information, our best guess is all we can do. And I think the HR people are setting too high a standard for themselves. We can't measure this perfectly. Well, nobody in business measures anything perfect. We don't measure productivity perfectly. We don't in any way measure what the effect of any change will be on share price. We don't know, but we act as if we do. In the absence of any information, you're going to lose the argument. And that's where we are.
That's a great point, not being perfect. Even your CFOs, they might tell you this, that they make judgment calls on where certain things go and how they think about the P&L, because they're trying to figure out exactly where all the costs are or where the revenue is coming from at times. And they may not even have that. So to your point, that's a really good point for HR leaders. Peter, let's talk about hiring, because you say it's the most important decision an organization can make. I agree with you. It is critical to get the right talent in. What is working and not working when it comes to how we select and hire people?
Well, we're not doing anything well. And you probably remember at some point in HR classes or psychology classes that interviews are lousy. Interviews are where bias comes in. And how do you generate bias? Well, it's there anyway. And so if you let managers pick their own questions, they don't know what the right answer is to a question. They don't know why they're asking the question. You're getting just garbage. You fill in when you don't have real facts is you fill it in with your gut. And whenever anybody says they're going with their gut, at least what I tell our MBA students in any field, if they say I'm going with my gut, what they're really saying is I'm probably going to do something really stupid, but it makes me feel good to do it. So managers go with their gut and you get bias. And the bias is they end up hiring people like them or people you have some similarity with. I've done these little experiments just asking people about scenarios, our own students, but managers as well. The answer is always the same. People want to be able to pick employees who they like. And they think it's like they're right, like picking out my own office furniture. I ought to be able to pick out employees who I like. And if you ask them, isn't it more important to pick somebody who performs well? Because you're not going to like somebody if they're very likable and they don't do the job and you got to clean it up afterwards. You're not going to like them very much. Well, yeah, but they end up just picking people they like. So we're terrible at this, right? And it's largely a cost-driven thing. We got rid of recruiters to save money, cut headcount. We don't train people on how to hire because training takes time and money. We push it off onto line managers. They don't know what they're doing. They don't hire enough, even get practiced at what they're doing. We're getting good at the vendor side at finding possible candidates. That's something. But the way hiring seems to work now is it's all on the recruiting side. For a while, talent management was the hot topic, which was about understanding your needs and figuring out how to fill them, training and hiring, internal development. Now it's talent acquisition. So it's only hiring. Forget about development. Forget about training. We're simply interested in hiring to fill our positions. Here's one that just blows me away, depending on which data you want to look at. We used to fill in big corporations about maybe 5% of vacancies from outside. We used to call them entry-level jobs. Those people you hired in out of school, everything else was filled from within. And you couldn't job hop because nobody would hire laterally. My father-in-law, who worked at International Harvester, told me, I asked him, did you ever hire anybody from outside? He was a director, so reasonably high. He said, yeah, we did that once. You can imagine how the rest of the conversation went. I said, how did it work? And he said, not well. And if you pressed him, he explained what happened. Everybody froze the new guy out. It was like rejecting an organ. So we used to fill 95% of our positions from within. Depending the data you want to look at, we now fill something like 10%, depending on the measure. Some say 20, some say as few as 6% of our vacancies from within. So we used to fill 95% from internal. Now we're filling 80 or so percent from outside. We completely ignored our internal talent. We don't develop them. We don't promote people. As a result, they hop across companies because there's no place to go internally. It's another example of why on earth would you do that? Well, it seems to be cheaper. But of course, it's not cheaper. But it might seem to be cheaper because that way we don't have to pay development costs. They're just like go under their coffee heading and accounting. And it's just cheaper to get people when we need them. Not if you look at how much you got to pay. And if you look at how poorly they perform compared to internal candidates. But nevertheless, that's the way we think about it, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. And a lot of times we will go out and we'll hire executive recruiters. We'll spend a lot of money to go to an executive. Could be $100,000 or more sometimes to get a placement, but we would definitely not go take $100,000 and invest in a development program. It's a very strange decision we make sometimes. And I wonder, Peter, do you think other things that were happening that people said, like, we just can't wait to develop people. We need this skill set now because the market's shifting so fast. And so I've got to go hire someone away who I think has that skill set. What do you think was the impetus of that? I know this is more in the 80s and this really started to happen. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there was some truth to that. The big companies were trying to figure out how to restructure. So you could see it, for example, when industries were deregulated. So for the first time, they would actually look at candidates who came from different industries that had already been deregulated. The belief before then was if you're trying to hire somebody in a railroad, they had to come from another railroad, or in electronics, they had to be an electronics person because the industry knowledge was so important. Well, it is important, but you know, sometimes there are lessons that other industries have that might actually be useful to you, sometimes different skill sets. IT kicked a lot of this off because IT is the one place in engineering where people can come out of college and contribute more or less right away. In those fields, companies just gave up trying to develop people, IT in particular. And by the way, that's why the IT companies were always the ones screaming about STEM skills and that sort of stuff, because they did need a big supply of people coming out of college. The problem from the college side, the student side, is those companies never knew for sure what they were going to need. And the IT market has gone through boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust. Now, because it will be really hot, then everybody piles into those majors. And then IT goes through a little downturn and all those people can't easily get jobs. So then they stop going into those majors, but it takes 4 or 5 years for them to graduate. In the meantime, the market picks up again and then the smaller cohort comes in. You know, it was just out of sync. And the employers were basically largely sitting on the sideline and just waiting for the engineering schools and computer science programs to deliver the people they wanted when they didn't even know what particular skills they were going to need until maybe a year or so out. So there's no way the colleges could deliver that. Right? So then they scream, we can't find the people to do this. And, oh, we need to go hire more foreign nationals because nobody here does that stuff. Well, nobody did it because you didn't tell them that you needed it. So, you know, because in those jobs, we have so completely externalized things to the market, but the market doesn't have the information to adjust. The students are killing themselves trying to figure out where the opportunities will be, but they just don't know. In fairness, the companies often don't know either, but you could retrain people and you could adapt the ones you got. If you're already a computer science person, figuring out how to use some of the new tools shouldn't take you that long. If you're an employer and you're willing to provide them with training.
Well, it's a great segue because I want to talk to you about skills because it's such an important topic. And for context, you wrote a book in 2012, which for some people is going to feel like a long time ago, called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap and What Companies Can Do About It. So I want to be very clear that skills has been something we've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah.
But now it's 2024, Peter, and we're still talking about skill gaps, skills-based organizations. How are you thinking about skills and potential skill gaps in 2024?
I wrote that book along with some others because I was irritated by the conversation. And in 2011 and 2010, and by 2012 for sure, employers were complaining there was no one to hire. And this was madness, right? Because 2 years before, you had millions of people who were employed. And the economy didn't change its structure in any way. The whole economy went down. It was a banking crisis. It wasn't driven by foreign competition or anything. The whole economy went down. The whole economy started to slowly come back up. But there was nobody to hire. What had started to happen was simply this. Once the economy started to recover, there was a little competition. Wages were going up a little bit, but not much. And what was really happening is companies could not find people to hire at the wage they had been paying in 2010. So in 2010, they were expecting and they could find machinists, trained experienced machinists for $15 an hour because there were just no jobs. So if you get used to that and then suddenly they couldn't find those people. So their response was, there's a skills gap problem. Something has happened to the supply. And by the way, people who have been studying this could look at this going back all the way through to the 1940s, where the same kind of thing was happening all the time, every few years, right? Labor market would adjust, employers say, sort of understandably, I didn't do anything different, and now I can't find people. it must be the market that screwed up. Well, the market isn't screwed up. It just got tighter. And you can't find people at those wages anymore. The unemployment rate was about 7%. And the companies were all saying, that's when the skill gap talk peaked, was, oh, there's nobody to hire. We have this massive skill problem. There was no massive skill problem. There were tons of people who could not get jobs. They struggled like crazy to get any kind of job, let alone the jobs they used to have. And yet the employers were kind of persuaded, and they persuaded other people, that we got this massive problem with the labor force. And yes, how could that be? Well, I said, well, the schools must be failing. Well, the schools only graduate 3 or 4% of the labor force. Most all the people that you're thinking about are already in the labor force. And by the way, you're not particularly interested in hiring people to leave school anyway. You're interested in hiring people who've already got experience. So it was clearly just not true what was going on. And then the other part of the book is we started to look at hiring practices, which were developed a little around the dot-com boom when companies really were, labor markets really tight, hard to find people. So they tried to make it easier and easier for people to apply with online job boards, for example. You don't need an application anymore, just go there. And it was super easy to apply, but then you had millions and millions of people who were unemployed. And so they were flooding the applicant tracking systems with applications. Typical person now will still apply to 100 jobs, but they might apply right. for 1,000 in those days, you know? And so the systems were overwhelmed and no one would ever hear back. The employees were frustrated, or the job seekers were frustrated. The employers were just overwhelmed by applicants, but they couldn't find people at the wage they wanted to pay and they weren't willing to adjust their wage. And if you pinned them down, as I often did, and said, could you find the people you want if you paid more? Well, yeah, but we can't afford to do that. You say, well, when your electricity rates go up, are you paying those? Well, yeah, we have to. But there was a belief that you didn't have to pay more to your employees somehow. Some of that was pushed on them by the pundit community around them and some of the consulting companies too, trying to persuade them this was not their fault. It was a public policy problem. So it was a nightmare for everybody.
Yeah. So what's so interesting is it feels like you're talking about 2024. How do you feel about now and today with that context? Are we seeing that again, where we've got low unemployment and people are saying there's a skills mismatch and that we've got these big issues?
Right now, it's not a great job market for white-collar workers. There are still a fair number of companies sitting on the sidelines. It's a bad job market, I'm told, for college graduates trying to leave and find jobs because investors have pushed companies to lay off or to sit on the sidelines for a while and not fill vacancies. It's not a great job market for everybody, but I think you're right. It is much better than the press kind of story indicates, right? We're still adding jobs and everything. And employers' wages have started to go up. It's still the case that they have barely broken even with inflation. So real wages have not gone up, despite all the talk about tight labor markets, right? But employers don't want to pay more, and understandably. So they're trying to figure out, what could we do differently? Then the topic of skills-based hiring has popped up, which I find this one kind of hilarious, because skills-based hiring is just what those personnel people would have told you 50 years ago you should do. Figure out what the job requires and then go look for people who've got that. Don't go look for people with a college degree if the job doesn't require college-level skills. But we got into that habit after the Great Recession because so many college graduates were flooding the market and you could hire them. So, for example, legal secretary used to be a job filled by high school graduates. After the Great Recession, it's a job filled by college graduates. The work didn't change. If anything, the work got simpler. But the reason they did it is they had all these college graduates available, so they hired. So skills-based hiring just means don't look at the degree, just look at whether people can do the job. That's what you should have always been doing. Right? Ask the question, why didn't it happen? I'll tell you why it didn't happen and why it's not going to happen. Because if you're going to do that, you have to take skill tests seriously. That is, you can't just rely that somebody had a course in accounting so they know something about accounting from college. Somebody tells you, I'm self-taught. Well, you got to test and see. That requires creating tests, validating tests, using the tests. And I just don't see any employers really doing that. They don't want to spend anything on it. But somehow, you got to figure out whether people have these skills if you want to do this. But they don't want to take the time. They don't want to spend the money. So it's not going to happen. So it's another just talk, talk, talk thing, right? It's not going to happen.
Yeah. And you've really kind of hit that piece. I think that's one of the core issues. We also don't even have a real definition around what skills are.
You can't have any assessments if you don't actually agree on what the skills are.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
What the systems are, all that kind of stuff. Otherwise, you, like, to your point, it's going to be
all over the board. And you'll remember, and everybody who's hired remember, the biggest problem is you can't agree on what you're looking for. And part of the reason for that is the people doing it are not skilled. It used to be the recruiter would come in and tell you, you don't need that requirement. And the reason they would say that is they know every requirement costs you money. So you don't need that. They don't need 5 years of experience. They don't need a master's degree to do this. But if you've got a committee together, you're just going around, what do you think we need? And so it'll be nice to have a master's degree. All right, we'll put that in. So you can't agree on what it is, and what you're asking for is unrealistic. And so you can't find people who have those attributes at the wage you want to pay. Not a surprise.
Really interesting, Peter. Let's talk a little about HR, because in 2015, you wrote an HBR article called Why We Love to Hate HR and What We Can Do About It. So I encourage people to go look at that article because it's interesting to kind of see the progression and history of HR. But more importantly, tell us about the article, but what's changed and hasn't changed about HR over that time period?
Yeah, well, you know, there's some things about HR that people hate, managers hate particularly, which are evergreen and they're necessary. We make people behave and they don't like that. Why can't I tell this joke? Well, because the joke offends people, that's why. Well, I don't think it offends people. Yeah, but other people do. You know, we make people behave. You can't wear that in the office. You can't hit on the interns. So we make people behave and they don't particularly like that. So that is an evergreen issue. I think as well, we have relied on being the compliance cops too much. We're pushed along by lawyers. The world of business is about assessing risks. It's not about driving risks to zero. And yet you often see organizations, employers trying to drive it to zero. Don't take any risk. Don't do anything that might lead us to some kind of exposure. This is where we get these crazy practices, like when we lay people off, marching them out of the office as soon as you tell them they're laid off. Guards walk them back to their desk. They can't say goodbye to anybody. Well, what if they decide to sabotage the equipment? Well, these days they could probably do it from home, right? They probably still have access in some way or other. Or worse, they could just badmouth you and sabotage you in Glassdoor and all these other places, right? We don't worry about that. I think that's the other reason is we relied too much on the compliance cop story. We didn't learn to speak the language of finance, which is how the rest of the company operates. Some of it is being too timid about raising these issues we were talking about earlier. Turnover costs us a lot of money. All those things, I think, started to pile up and create a kind of hole for human resources where people didn't see that it was helping them do much. And to some extent, there's also kind of a misunderstanding. We saw this in the Me Too movement, right? Where a lot of people, women who had problems in the office with men, and men who had problems with women or men too, thought that HR was there to protect them. And it's not really. HR works for the company. They do what the company wants them to do. They don't have legal obligations to protect you independent of the obligations the company has to you. Right? So I think some of that was kind of a misunderstanding as well. But getting more articulate about value propositions, paying more attention to candidates, something which has gotten better, I think, and thinking about the experience that employees have, something else which has gotten better, are all things that would make people hate it less.
Let's talk about what advice would you have for HR leaders, and specifically, what would you like to see HR leaders doing differently in 2024 and beyond?
I think one of the big issues we have to come to grips with is how much of what we do is outsourced. A colleague and I, Shoshana Schwartz, and I started just to tally up how big is the vendor community. If you count everything, like leased employees and managed service providers, all that stuff that you could outsource work and jobs, it's $1.9 trillion. So it is the size of the Italian GNP, at least the official Italian GNP, right? It is a huge number. And we ought to start thinking about, are we actually using our vendors appropriately? What sorts of things would you really like to see or most like to see done outside the organization? Do we really want to be pushing our core tasks outside the organization? Do we want, you know, employee relations done outside the organization rather than inside the organization? Do we really want to outsource our hiring issues? The big problem we're seeing with this is we've been picking vendors one by one, task by task. And of course, they don't talk to each other and they've each got pieces of the data pie and they can't figure out, we can't figure out how to get that data to talk to each other. So we're awash in data and we can't do anything with it. So I would say that's the biggest thing. Could we get better at managing the relationship with vendors? I mean, vendors are responsible now for all the ideas, all the action. They're driving the agenda because they're driving the PR stories. But we have to think about how to use them more carefully. And we haven't done that very well, particularly what do we want to retain in-house? I think the other thing we just don't know very much about yet is whether some of the generative AI stuff, the large language models like ChatGPT in particular, might allow employers to analyze data in a way that does not require such big startup costs. A few years ago, when we were getting people analytics people together, that is the people who did it for companies, the biggest problem they had, which has been true for a long time, was database management, the simplest stuff. We just can't get the performance data and the applicant tracking data systems to share data, and merging them is a pain and it takes years to get it cleaned up. So we got all this data. We can't look to see whether our practices work, even if we wanted to, right? So will that help? Will ChatGPT and these other places help? It might. And I think the HR folks probably don't want to be laggards on that, because what will happen is it will be taken over by the IT people. They'll do it for you. And then HR is in an even smaller box. That's the big thing to think about. We're going to lose even more turf. A lot of things have been pushed out to the line managers to make it cheaper, but it's worse. And do we want IT to take over the analysis of human resource issues? They will find a lot of stuff they think is cool. You know what is a good predictor? Hire white men, because they've always done well in the past. That's what they'll find. And somebody, junior person in the bottom of the IT department, will come running to the CEO with the answer as to who to hire. You know, hire a white man. So you really don't want those folks getting their hands on HR data to make recommendations. So HR has got to get in front of that. And I think it's also got to figure out, what do they not want to bother with? We were talking earlier about shiny objects. And there's a lot of stuff in the outside community that HR gets pulled into, like these wacky generational stories. Somebody claims there's a new generation about every 2 years. There's zero evidence this is true, and a lot of evidence it's not true. But also, what are you going to do about it anyway? I mean, you're actually going to try to convince your managers to manage people who are 3 years apart differently. I mean, it's a complete fool's errand, and it's a waste of time. We could be doing things that really matter.
Really valuable, Peter. Last question for you. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's the same word, which has been true for business for a long time, and that's uncertainty. And the question is, will we take uncertainty seriously? Or will we still go through these big planning exercises, assuming we know where the business is going to be in 5 years? Will we still be doing succession plans, even though we throw them out because the business always changes or new leaders come in? We do workforce plans, but they never work because the business forecasts on which they rest don't work either. We're going to think about how we can manage this uncertainty. It's not a new question. We were starting to make some progress on this before the Great Recession, and then everything got put on hold. Same thing happened, by the way, before the pandemic. We were starting to make progress on performance management and performance appraisals. And then pandemic hit, all that stuff just froze. We went back to what we were doing before. So we have to catch our breath a little bit and actually punch through on some of these things and institutionalize them.
Uncertainty is the future of HR. Peter, thank you so much for being on the Future of HR. It's an incredible conversation. So much great historical knowledge, but also can take that into the future, understanding where we're going, so we're going to repeat some of the past mistakes. Thank you again for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Peter for sharing his insights and his years of research from his latest book, Our Least Important Asset, Why the Relentless Focus on Finance and Accounting is Bad for Business and Employees. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. If you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe, share our podcast with at least one other person,
or leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us grow the podcast and helps their mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with a big episode. Why is next week a big episode? Well, next week will be Future of HR Podcast 100th episode. It's a big milestone for the podcast, and I'm excited to see that our guests next week will be Kevin Cox and Anthony Nyberg. Kevin is the founder and president of LKC Advisory, a leadership advisory firm partnering with CEOs and CHROs to maximize the full potential of their organizations and leadership teams. Kevin retired as GE's Human Resources Officer in April 2024 and previously served as CHRO of American Express and Pepsi Bottling Group. Kevin is known to many as the Dean of CHROs, and he's established a reputation both as a business and thought leader with over 25 years of CHRO experience across three different industries. Joining Kevin is Anthony Nyberg. Anthony is a professor of management at University of South Carolina's Darlan Moore School of Business, where in addition to his full-time faculty role, he serves as the faculty director for the Center for Executive Succession. In my conversation with Kevin and Anthony, we're going to go deep on executive succession, what works, what doesn't work, and what you can do to do this more successfully in your organization. This conversation was a masterclass on executive succession and a chance to learn from one of the best CHROs in the business. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.